The Burrows of Berea is a conversational podcast.
We study the Bible and we talk about it.
Not all of us are of the same faith.
And one of us doesn't have a faith.
But we still love one another, and we're going to continue to talk about these things.
The things we believe in and the things we believe about what we read in the Bible. Not all of these are necessarily true. Some of it is opinion and speculation. Thank you for
listening and speculating with us.
There you go. That was good. Yes.
You are listening to the Burrows of Berea.
Hey guys, this is Andy. This episode is a follow-up to the Ed Stevens interview. Rick and Big Daddy Carter sit back down to ask him questions and discuss his work on the topic of full preterism. Enjoy.
All right, we're back with Mr. Ed Stevens, who has graciously given us some time. Got Big Daddy Carter here.
He's
over there like a little kid in front of the candy store.
Oh, man, you aren't kidding. This is Christmas right here. Santa Claus is real.
Yeah. So we wanted this time, Mr. Stevens, because Rick and I talk on a daily basis, sometimes for 30 minutes, sometimes for 2 hours, and then it goes on, and we go back and forth. And so I wanted to give him an opportunity to talk to you about the subject of death, dead, and dying, as well as sin being removed from the world and the ramifications of that, flesh and the spirit, all of this. So, Rick, I'm going to let you take it away.
Oh, my goodness.
And if you can answer those questions, that's great. And if not, we'll always come back to it. We'll study again. But that's the idea, is we just want to be able to throw these things out with somebody that was a full preterist right after I was born, 3 months after I was born.
Yeah, I wasn't even a thought in my parents' mind at that particular time.
A twinkle
born long after.
A twinkle in your parents' eye.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, sure it was.
So Rick, I'm going to mute my mic, and then if I have a feeling like I want to jump in like, that's not what you said, then we're going to
No, you can come in at any time.
All right, there you go. It's all you.
So, Mr. Stevens, one thing we talked about in our kind of our discussion about preterism, have you ever considered that the context of dying, being dead, and the death are three different things?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, the word death and dead is used with several connotations in our New Testament. It's not a monolithic term at all. Each of those words have multiple different connotations and nuances that need to be checked with the context. You know, the context is the king,
right,
trying to determine the meaning of a word or a phrase. The context is where we focus to derive that meaning.
Well, I would say if anything was above context, it would be audience relevance. Audience relevance would be first, then there would be context, and then every hermeneutical step would be below that.
Right.
So that's so we mentioned something a little bit, and we talked a lot when Rick mentioned that we keep going back to the beginning, which would be Genesis. The death of Adam, how do you feel that is based on your time that you've spent studying it?
Well, in Genesis 2:17, God introduced the tree of life and the tree of knowledge of good and evil to Adam. And this was before he made Eve. So Eve was not in on that conversation. Adam was, and Adam told Eve about it later after she was created. But notice God says to Adam, in the day you eat from that tree, you will surely die. And we know from Genesis chapter 3, where Satan deceived Eve, that she understood that death threat to be physical death. And we know that because when she mentioned that she didn't want to even to eat it or even to touch it, lest we die, she was thinking of it in physical terms very clearly. And so when she found out that there was no danger of eating it and dying, she stretched out her hand and grabbed it and ate it. her main concern was physical death. And so we know that Adam must have told her about that. And so she got that impression of physical death from Adam. And evidently Adam got it from God, but their eyes had not been opened yet. They had not sinned, and therefore their eyes had not been opened. And so they were not aware of the other aspects of death that was threatened against them. They had no clue what spiritual death was. And so the only kind of death they understood at that point was a physical death threat. But then they sinned, and their eyes were opened, and then they realized that there was more to the death threat than just physical death. And what is very interesting is that God had already planned all of this before the ages began, before creation. He already had his plan in place to redeem fallen man. And so when Adam and Eve sinned, God didn't say, uh-oh, I got to change my plan here. He already had his plan in place, and that plan was to redeem man by substitute sacrifice. God had already planned to send his son into the world to die on behalf of and in the place of sinful man. And so we see that acted out right there in the garden in the very beginning. In Genesis 3:15, he tells Eve that because you have been deceived by Satan, that there will come a day one of your children, one of your descendants, will stomp the head of the serpent. We see that in just six verses later, we see that acted out. How is the seed of Eve going to stomp the head of the serpent? How does he do that? Well, six verses later in Genesis 3:21, God clothed them with garments of skin. And the word skins there is talking about animal skins. So evidently, God sacrificed some animals and took the skins and clothed Adam and Eve with those skins. Now, that means that they killed, that God killed and slayed these innocent animals on their behalf. And so it was a substitute sacrifice on their behalf, which covered their shame and also died on their behalf. It was a death of an innocent lamb in the place of Adam and Eve, who would have died if a substitute had not died in their place. And so from the very beginning in Genesis, in the Garden of Eden, we see the idea of the scarlet thread that runs throughout the rest of the Bible, pointing to Jesus. The way that the seed of Eve would stomp the head of Satan is by giving himself as a substitute sacrifice for Adam and Eve and their descendants.
Gotcha. So would you say that the death that Adam and Eve were a part of was a spiritual death?
Well, it was a first death and second death. You know, in Revelation, it talks about the second death, and which is eternal death, spiritual death. And the first death, of course, is understood as being physical death. So you die first physically, and then you're ushered into the second death. If you've not repented and you're not one of God's people, then you will endure the second death forever. And so there's a first death and a second death, and both of those deaths are included in the death that was threatened against Adam and Eve.
Okay.
So if Adam and Eve had died physically on that day, if they had been struck dead on the spot when God showed up, and not sacrificed for, then what would have happened after their physical death? They would have been put into the second death immediately. And so they would have suffered both kinds of death immediately on that very day. But God substituted a sacrifice for them, and therefore they didn't die physically. Therefore, they didn't go into the second death on that day either. So they were saved from both kinds of death.
So really, they were, what we're seeing is that separation from God, the separation from Eden. But you're not saying that's a spiritual death. It's just a separation from God, basically removing him from the realm, that realm.
Yeah, Romans 8, Apostle Paul talks about that death, that sin death, as being condemnation. So from the very moment that Adam and Eve sinned, they were under the condemnation to die.
Okay.
That's what we refer to as sin death, that it's condemnation to die both kinds of death. They would die physically as a penal death on that very day, and that would usher them into the second death in the unseen realm.
Okay.
So when we refer to spiritual death, we're referring to what's going to happen to them after they die physically. The sin death is actually just condemnation to die both kinds of death.
So let me take you down a path, and you may not have to join me if you don't want, but what if the context of what we can find in Scripture points out that possibly that it was just a physical death that he was referring to, that Eve thought that they were going to have, that the spiritual context of it at that time hadn't developed itself yet until later?
Right. Well, their eyes had not been opened yet, so they didn't understand the spiritual ramifications of it. But God originally in Genesis 2:17 threatened both kinds of death.
Well, the spiritual side in the beginning of the Bible, I'm having a hard time in my understanding that as soon as Adam and Eve were created, there wasn't a spiritual realm yet. The spiritual realm didn't develop until they were going to die. Once they die, that is when death entered, and that was where the spiritual realm developed.
Now, wait a second.
Yes, sir.
Was Satan and the angels there at that point of creation?
They were, because everything was together at that time.
So there's a spiritual realm.
Well, not in... The hard part is there's not enough context that we know of that there is a separation between the spiritual realm and the natural realm during their days. It wasn't until dying developed because of Adam and Eve eating of that fruit that there would become an afterlife or what we consider today as a spiritual realm.
Okay, yeah, I would agree with one point on that. That is the idea that there was no such thing as Sheol, a place that was a place of separation and waiting for the judgment day. There was no need for it at that point because there was no humans who had sinned who were under condemnation to suffer eternal death. And so there was no Sheol at that point. But there was an unseen realm where there were angels. Satan was one of them.
So do you think that they saw him or they didn't see him because they were in the unseen realm?
That's a good question. The Scripture doesn't tell us that Adam and Eve saw Satan. They did see a snake, and Satan was evidently speaking through that snake to them.
That's a possibility.
Yeah, so that's a really good. I never thought of it that way. It's kind of like the way we describe, let's say, like temptation for ourselves today, at least the modern way of thinking. We don't see these unseen things, whether they exist or they don't. At some point, these unseen demonic forces were here for sure. So you don't see them, but you see the effect on them.
Exactly. Right?
So yeah. Then you can determine, like, yeah, there's that serpent. That's why later on in Revelation, it'll say that serpent, that old serpent, the devil, like right. he he understood that what that serpent was representing was the adversary to what God had planned for man and woman.
Right. So when the death happened, I'm sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, it's like demon possession, you know.
Right.
It's the same thing with the serpent in the garden. Satan was speaking through that serpent.
It'd be the same thing when Balaam and the donkey speaking through the animal.
Now God enabled that donkey to speak. Yeah.
Yeah. Gotcha. All right. So on the death part of they dying, and this is the part I'll lead you down a little bit, and it leads into chapter 6 of Genesis. What if God's time was different, or the man's time was different or more compatible with God's time at the time when Adam and Eve were born, and then God decided to change it?
I'm not following you. Maybe you can explain that a little bit more.
All right. So doing a study with Rick about going through the chapter, first beginning of chapters, I stumbled on some context in it's 2 Peter 3:8. It's a verse that's pretty well quoted.
I'll pull it up on the screen so we can just read it. Because it's you're talking about the fact?
Yep.
Okay, let me pull it up. All right, I believe you're going to go here.
Yep. The interesting part of reading this, and I had never seen it before until it's probably been a couple years now. It said, do not let this one fact escape your notice. Now, the term that I had never really paid much attention to was the fact it says one fact. That if Peter, and I looked through the different translations, and they all say fact. That the upcoming, if you would say, if you're a mathematician, that the ratio between 1,000 years and a day had to be something real. It had to be factual. There had to be something that you could base it on in order to write a fact. It wasn't fiction. So I said, well, all right, if it's a ratio is one day is 1,000 years, so one day of God's time is 1,000 of our years, is there anywhere in the Bible that I could apply that to that would help me understand that? And the first place I found was Adam and Eve.
This episode is brought to you by Carolina Cases. Whether in your home, auto, suitcase, or hotel, you can be assured that with Carolina Cases, you can protect what matters most. Carolina Cases are TSA approved, so you know that your items are secure in a shock and impact-proof hard case. These lightweight, durable cases come with pre-cut, protective, high-quality foam to fit your pistol by make and model, compact size or full size. They come in a universal configuration for multiple options. Carolina Cases are more than a pistol case. They are available in fully customizable foam to protect what matters. You can go to their website at www.carolinacases.net to see their designative, protective lid designs. Each is laser engraved to give you unmatched style at home or on the range. So to protect what matters most, visit www.carolinacases.net. That's www.carolinacases.net. Enter code Burrows, that's B-U-R-R-O-S, at checkout to receive free shipping. That's right. Just enter Burrows at checkout and you'll receive free shipping.
The Jewish rabbis made that very same application. And that's where they talked about God negotiating with the angels. And the angels said, well, you promised to kill him on the very day he ate. And God said, this is in the rabbinical arguments, you know, in the Talmud. God said, well, was I speaking of one of his days or one of my days?
Ooh. So if you look at how long he lived, and I know that we've had this discussion with several, with a different author. What was that author, Rick, that we talked about? That most of the, who?
Craig Olson, the archaeologist.
Yeah. Where he talks about where there most of the time time statements that are written in the Old Testament were more of a hyperbole. But if I take it on faith that Adam lived 930 years.
He was talking about not really hyperbole, but just that, I guess it was hyperbole, about the ages of men being like Methuselah being 969, that it wasn't truly 969. That was an inflated number to show that he was like very important to the people, which was something that other tribes at that time in the Mesopotamian area did. That's what Craig Olson was saying, but that's not what you're saying necessarily.
So if I take it on faith that they were writing the best that they understood, and if he lived to be 930 years, then that would actually mean that if you relate that to God's time, that he died the very day, but he died a day of God's time, not our own time.
Yeah, and the rabbis make that very argument.
So I said, well, where else can I apply this to if this ratio means something? It's interesting that I don't know if you read pseudepigraphal writings at all, but in the book of Adam and Eve, in the very beginning of it, it specifically states that God told Adam that he was going to have to wait 5.5 days before he would be redeemed and brought back to God, that he'd have to wait. And then it states right after that, because Adam didn't understand, what do you mean 5.5 days? Then it goes and states that it would be 5,500 years
right,
that he would be redeemed. So wait a minute. There's a dead connection here between the day and 1,000 years. So I kept reading. And I actually had put it out online about the study. I also found in the Gospel of Nicodemus that the Gospel of Nicodemus after Christ is dead, and there's a discussion with Pilate, and he talks to Annas and Caiaphas, and he wants to know what happened because something big happened when Christ died, and he didn't understand what happened, and he wanted them to tell him what happened. And during that story, they sent everybody out, and they had this discussion, and they brought this big book out. It was encrusted with jewels, possibly the Book of Life, but it was a very big book. And they said, after Christ died and all the things that had happened, we went back through this book and started looking at what was written in this thing. And we found and now believe that he was the Christ. They pointed to the fact that that we were told by God through signs of the timing of when Christ would come. And one of the signs was the Ark of the Covenant. The size of the Ark of the Covenant was, by its measure, was 5.5 cubits in dimension, the square foot, because 2.5 by 1.5 by 1.5 by measurement, by cubits. So the total space of the inside of the covenant, or the Ark of the Covenant, was 5.5 cubits. And they said, if you multiply that by 1,000 years, that's 5,500 years from the time of Adam to the time of Christ.
Yeah, and it says that in the Gospel of Nicodemus. They're actually teaching you this number, how it works.
Wow.
So now that's on faith that these writings have any validity.
Well, and there's more than that. If you look at the Book of Enoch, for example,
yes,
and Jasher.
Oh, man, I love Jasher.
Sibylline Oracles and some of these other apocryphal books. One of them, I'm not sure if it's Enoch or Jasher or what, refers to the Messiah coming in the 5th or 6th millennium. I think it's the 6th millennium, and ushering in, you know, the world to come. And what's interesting is that the rabbis were familiar with,
yes,
the Book of Enoch and the Book of Jasher. And so after 70 AD, they fudged the numbers in Genesis 10 and 11 and Genesis 5 also, where it talks about the age of the patriarchs. And if you'll compare the Septuagint version, which was not changed, with the Hebrew, which was changed by the rabbis after 70 AD, you'll notice that there's about 1,200 years difference in the length of time from creation down to Abraham.
Christ. for Abraham?
Down to Abraham. There's like 1,200 more years in the Septuagint version. And that's because...
That goes along with what Craig Olson said, Rick. And Craig Olson wrote a book, Mr. Stevens, about that. And he said, he didn't mention the Septuagint, but he said, according to archaeological data, that Abraham was on the earth 1,200 years later than what the Genesis account had stated.
Exactly.
Yeah, so that's even archaeological evidence.
There's a guy by the name of Henry B. Smith. He works for the Associates for Biblical Archaeology. He's working on this chronology between the Septuagint and the Hebrew, and he's showing that the Septuagint is the more accurate chronology to go with, and that pushes the date of creation back 1,200 years. But what's interesting is that the rabbis recognized that Jesus had arrived on the scene at the right time.
Yeah.
And so they had to fudge the numbers in Genesis to give their Messiah another 1,200 years to appear.
Oh, my goodness. Wow. So leading back to the death of Adam, I see it as a legitimate, just a physical death that he died. And he did die within the day that God said he would die. We just misunderstand the amount of time.
Yeah, and I mentioned that very thing in my Fall of Adam paper.
Good.
I deal with that.
I look forward to reading that. Now, the part about the spiritual part would be that when he died is when death came on the scene and there was a spiritual realm, and that's when Hades was developed, right, or the place of creation of Hades was stored. And that's where death, according to Paul, ruled and reigned prior to Noah. And then in chapter 6 is where God, because of the little bit that's spoken of the Nephilim and the total depravity of man, where God begins to take, if you could take our biological clock, he sped it up to where we would live only 120 years.
Or is he saying that he gave them 120 more years before he would bring the flood? And that's the way I would interpret it, is that he gave Noah another 120 years to build the ark and get ready for the flood.
I can't disagree with that at all, except for when you start looking at the lineages of life, is they dramatically begin to drop off
after the flood.
After the point, yeah, they start dropping to where it's close to 200, give or take, and then eventually man doesn't live more than roughly what we live now, 80 to 100 years.
Right.
So the other part that I found interesting in that ratio, do you know how much of an hour of God's time is to our years?
It's awesome.
No, I've never thought about that.
It turns out that 1 hour of God's time to our years is 41.66667 years.
41 it third years.
Falls right in with a generation time.
Or what you would say if you were to say the last hour.
So when John is talking about the last hour, and I think when Christ is talking about when his hour comes, he is referring to the 40 years from his death to 70 AD.
From whose death? From Jesus' death?
From Jesus' death until 70 AD would happen. And that's the hour that's referred to in multiple times throughout the New Testament. And that's where, again, if it's a fact, then there's ways to prove it. And I think that is how we can prove that's real, that timing is real. And the other part is, well, people will say, well, it was like. Well, the only part that I could say was like is that it means it wasn't a perfectly even number, but it was close. It was close to the ratio. So when I looked at John saying we're at the last hour, that falls right in line. He's talking about the impending events coming. Jesus, in the very beginning, he says, no man knows the hour, which meant no one knew when he would actually die or the day he would die, so the hour would start. He said only the Father would knew, but if you look at his what he begins to say later, he starts to define when the hour is going to start. Because by the time he gets to the Garden of Gethsemane is when he begins to say, my hour has come. So he now understands when the hour clock comes because it's related to his death.
Right.
Does any of that seem?
Yeah, I have no problem with that. That sounds very interesting.
So the part that we, and to circle back to the beginning part that we was asking about the variances, is through my studies, I begin to see that there's a definite distinction between death, dead, and dying. Every man is set to die. Every man, every woman, every child. We're all going to die. That could have been averted if Adam was allowed to eat from the tree of life again, but for whatever reason, God chose not to. So from that point on, and that's after the point of they were going to die, that's when they were taught to procreate because they needed to, because they were going to die. If they didn't procreate, there would be no humanity left. They would just die off. So you get to that point, and from the part of Adam until Abraham is where that everybody died. They went to Sheol. They went to death. When Abraham came on the scene and he was now declared righteous, which is the first man to be declared righteous because of faith, when he died, or anybody that would die that was righteous would be considered dead. The context is really interesting in the discussion that Jesus had about Lazarus, was Jesus said that his dying will not result in death. Well, they thought he was asleep, like he took a nap. But Jesus said, no, he is dead. So even in Jesus' context, he did directly, definitively splits death and dead apart.
Right.
There's two different things. The context that I've also seen with death is that if you reach death, that was a place that God couldn't get to. Or either there was an agreement set up that he
chose
could
not to. Or chose not to.
Or chose not to. But if you had died after Abraham and you were dead, that was a place that you could be resurrected from.
Hence, now, Samuel, as far as a spirit, you would say.
Well,
the sin and death deal is set up as a court session. And in Book of Acts, I think it's chapter 17, verse 31, it says that God appointed a day when he would judge the world. And so when did he appoint that day of judgment? It was, you know, way back at the very beginning, before creation. He set up that time in the future when he would judge the world based on his bringing salvation into the world.
Well, and could that also be when he developed righteousness through Abraham?
Right. Yeah. And it's in agreement with what you're saying, is that there was a waiting place. They waited in Sheol until that appointed day of judgment, when they would be raised out of Sheol and judged.
Now, the interesting part is I'm not sure if the dead were actually in Sheol. Because if you got to Sheol, nobody could be resurrected from it. Nobody ever was. Nobody prior to Abraham had ever been resurrected. The only person that never met death was Enoch prior to Abraham. After that was, is it Elijah? Elijah didn't meet death.
Right.
So there was two particular cases prior to that that nobody went through the process. So that seems like there's a different connotation between the three. Now, what I find interesting, and I'll get to the part, the next part would be, I guess, the discussion of sin. Now, you applied sin to being to what Adam did, which is interesting, is if we use audience relevance all the time, like we're supposed to, because you can never change it, would Adam understand what sin was?
No, he didn't before he sinned. No, his eyes had not been opened yet.
Well, even after they were opened, would he have understood what sin was?
Yeah, he was ashamed. The biblical text says that he was ashamed and afraid.
You're right. It does. Now, there's nothing in, as far as I can tell, in Scripture that associates shame and afraid with sin. The interesting thing is that the part of their eyes being open and now they focused on themselves, they had never looked upon themselves in the way they had looked then.
Right.
Now, we've had this discussion with Rick so the author says that when God talks to Cain and he says, be careful that sin crouches at your door. Now, the interesting thing is if Genesis was written before Moses, would the author have ever written the fact that sin crouched at the door? And I ask this question because Paul tells us that the law was written to define sin. So when was the law developed? It was developed during the days of Moses because he brought down the law. And he also wrote Genesis. Could it be possible that when the writer Moses, that when he wrote Genesis, that he wrote the act of what Cain was doing as a sin because he understood it as sin because he brought the law down?
No, I think those records go further back than Moses. In fact, it says in Genesis that in Exodus, it says that Moses was educated under all the knowledge of Egypt because he was Pharaoh's adopted son.
Right.
And so he was educated in all that knowledge. And chances are pretty good that the Egyptian library had some of those records, ancient records. And the Jews, whenever they migrated down into Egypt, brought those records with them that they had received from Isaac and Abraham, and all the way back to Noah. Noah had those records with him on the ark.
So, and that's pretty cool. I could agree with that. But would they have understood the acts of quote-unquote evil, as we know that they were participating in, would that be defined as sin because the law hadn't been presented yet to understand what it was?
Oh, yeah, they knew what sin was. They knew that they were disobeying God. And disobedience is sin.
Transgression against God.
Yeah, that's right.
So getting to the, just fast forwarding to the point where John the Baptist is standing in the Jordan. He sees Christ coming over the ridge. And he says that here's the man that take away the sin of the world. From a long-term preterist, where do you think sin stands today based on the statement that John the Baptist was talking about?
Well, human nature has not changed and never will. You know, we're still the same kind of people that Adam and Eve were.
Right.
And we disobey God just like they did, you know.
Right. So is their sin during those days the same as the sin today?
Yeah, it's disobedience.
The act in itself. All right. So here's another interesting point. And I've got the question of sin. In Romans 9, yep, there it is, verse 8.
All right, here we are, verse 8. But sin, taking opportunity through the commandment, produced in me coveting of every kind. For apart from the law, sin is dead.
How would we as preterists reconcile the fact that Paul is making a huge statement here? As preterists, we understand that the law in itself was dying off the scene. It was dying off because
The law was fulfilled.
It was fulfilled, but it was also dying off because of the fact that the temple would be destroyed at 70 AD. So when the law went away, and Paul is saying that sin is dead, how do we reconcile those two parts about sin today?
Well, I think we need to be very careful
I understand.
Not to read into that text what we want to be there. You know, the Israel only folks are really good at that.
Right. And,
we know they're wrong, you know, and so we need to be very careful how we approach texts like this. But the Jewish people, when they formulated their list of 613 mitzvot or commandments, they listed as one of those commandments Genesis 2:17, where God said, "Do not eat from this tree, because in the day you eat thereof, you will surely die." And so that was a commandment. At least the Jewish people consider that a commandment, which is a part of the law. It was the law of God. That was the first expression of do's and don'ts that the Jewish people recognize as a part of the law. And so the law of God was put into place from the very beginning with Adam and Eve.
So where would the law be today?
Well, the law of God is written in our hearts.
It's not just
a code of commandments in the Old Testament. It's God's moral and ethical and spiritual law that is written in our hearts.
Do you remember where the written on our hearts started from? Do you remember which part of the Bible that came from?
I think it's Old Testament, because he talks about the future. It's one of the prophets who's looking forward to the time when, I think it's in Isaiah, because God says that he's going to write it on their hearts. There's going to come a time, they're looking forward to that time where he will write it on their foreheads and in their hearts, right? Isn't that where it's, I think it's Isaiah.
It's Jeremiah 31.
Jeremiah 31, I'll pull it up.
Yeah, it's quoted in Hebrews 8:10.
Oh, so we'll go to both of those. I'll go to Jeremiah 31 and read it there, and then go to Hebrews 10.
8:10.
Okay, Jeremiah 31, and then 8:10, you said.
Right.
All right, 31. Whereabouts?
31 through 33.
So he says, "Behold, days are coming, declares the Lord, when I will make a new covenant with the house of Israel and with the house of Judah, not like the covenant which I made with their fathers in the day I took them by the hand to bring them out of the land of Egypt, my covenant which they broke, although I was a husband to them, declares the Lord. But this is the covenant which I will make with the house of Israel after those days, declared the Lord. I will put my law within them, and on their heart I will write it, and I will be their God, and they shall be my people. They will not teach again, each man his neighbor and each man his brother, saying, Know the Lord, for they will all know me, from the least of them to the greatest of them, declares the Lord, for I will forgive their iniquity, and their sin I will remember no more."
What if I was to tell you that there is a New Testament fulfillment of that?
Well, I'd have to see it.
Go to Romans chapter 2, starting in verse 14.
"For when Gentiles who do not have the law instinctively the things of the law, these, not having the law, are a law to themselves, in that they show the work of the law written in their hearts, their conscience bearing witness, and their thoughts alternately accusing or else defending them, on the day when, according to my gospel, God will judge the secrets of men through Christ Jesus."
Yeah, what does that mean when he says instinctively do the things of the law? How in the world could they do that if it wasn't built into their conscience?
Right. And it would be the same thing as God telling Cain that if you do what is right, I'll bless you.
Right.
In the same context, is that there's a divide between, I always thought that Gentiles were separated and never had an opportunity at basically salvation after Abraham, but in fact they actually did, that their salvation to die unrighteously was their salvation was through faith.
Right.
That connected them to Abraham. So prior to that understanding, which is written in Galatians by Paul, when he's stating about, you know, they were connected to Abraham through faith, which also finds it it also brightened up the picture when the Gentile people came to Jesus, like the woman with the sick child. Every time he did something for a Gentile, he did it because of the faith that they were exhibiting at the moment. So,
and that goes all the way. That goes all the way back to Adam. You look at Adam, whenever after they sinned, and God, said that there was going to be a redeemer that would come to them, and then it says that Adam named his wife Eve because of that promise in Genesis 3:15 that her descendant would produce a savior who would crush the serpent's head. Adam believed that, and he named his wife Eve, mother of all living, in view of that promise to send a descendant who would stomp the head of the serpent. And so all the way from the very beginning, the first sinner who believed in that promise was able to have, God produce a sacrifice for them. And so the sacrifice and forgiveness of Adam and Eve was based on their faith, just like Abraham did, just like all the patriarchs did. Those who believed were saved.
Right. So when, in essence, when the Gentiles came to Jesus and they exhibited big faith, even though he stated that in that particular situation, doesn't she know that I've only come to seek the lost sheep of the house of Israel, which he at that moment was only for them. He was bound by faith in the connection to Abraham to participate in their request, to give them what they asked for.
Right.
So it wasn't.
Sorry, Rick, I would go a step further. Whenever he was in Nazareth and he's sharing that who he is, he talks about shortly after, he says to them, he talks about Naaman the Syrian, and because he says, surely you'll say, physician, heal thyself, because no prophet is acceptable in his own town. But then he goes on, and what really angers those men that want to throw him off a cliff is that both cases where Elijah took care of the Shulamite woman and where Naaman the Syrian was given, was healed of his leprosy, those were Gentiles. And that's what angered them, is because he was going to be kind to the Gentiles. They were getting angry because it was being taken from them. Although he's announcing the day of the Lord on that day, the joy, the glorious joy of the Lord, right?
Right.
This episode is brought to you by Carolina Cases. Whether in your home, auto, suitcase, or hotel room, you can be assured that with Carolina Cases, you can protect what matters most. Carolina Cases are TSA approved, so you know your items are secured in a shock and impact-proof hard case. These lightweight, durable cases come with pre-cut, protective, high-quality foam to fit your pistols by make and model, compact size, or full size. They also come in a universal configuration for multiple options. Carolina Cases are more than a pistol case. They are available in fully customizable foam to protect what matters. You can go to their website at www.carolinacases.net to see their designer protective lid designs. Each is laser engraved to give you unmatched style at home or on the range. So protect what matters most. Visit www.carolinacases.net. That's www.carolinacases.net. Enter code Burrows at checkout to receive free shipping. That's right. Just enter the code Burrows at checkout and you'll receive free shipping.
Sorry, that's why Peter got into such hot water when he went down to Cornelius's house and preached the gospel to them and converted them without circumcision and law keeping. Now, can you imagine what would have happened to Peter if he had tried to circumcise Cornelius, who was a Roman centurion? The Romans had a law forbidding that, and they would have put to death Peter on the spot if he had tried to circumcise Cornelius. Wow. Now, when Peter got back to Jerusalem, he was called on the carpet. Why did you go to Gentiles, unclean Gentiles, and preach the gospel, and then you didn't circumcise them, and you accepted them as fellow Christians? How can you do that, Peter? And Peter says, hey, While I was speaking, the Holy Spirit fell upon them, just as he did on us Jews at Pentecost. And he cleansed their heart by faith.
Yes.
Wow.
Which proves faith without works is dead. So every time faith exhibited itself, something worked. Something right. happened.
Right.
Man, that's good stuff.
Yeah.
That's good stuff. So I guess one more thing.
So now you want to send this baby into the stratosphere? Here's your chance, mister. Here's your chance.
All right. So we'll talk about what you brought into to 1 Corinthians 15.
You want me to open it up?
I'm going to bring it up too, because I also like the CSB, and I know he likes the New American Standard.
Well, that's where I've got all my notes and my memory work.
Totally fine. Totally fine. You can do the NSB on this one, and I'll look at the 15.
We're going to 1 Corinthians 15. Okay.
Yeah, we get down to the bottom where he brought in at verse 50. All right. So when Jesus comes, there's a big discussions right now, and I'm not sure how connected you are and what circles you've been connected a long time. There's big discussions about covenants with the Bible. Because it's easy to define that there's an old covenant, there's a new covenant. And some people want to go back and say that there was a covenant with Adam. Now, I mean, it's for me, that's somewhat debatable, because when I went and done a study on covenants, there seems to be a pattern at which when God created a covenant, there's a way that he did it versus way God created a covenant versus what man does to create a covenant with each other. There's a huge difference, and there's a pattern to what he does. So when you get into the discussion about the change between the old covenant and the new covenant, which I believe a lot of the New Testament people were going through, that the change that he was referring to, that I think that Paul was referring to, was the changing of a person that was born to the old covenant, that they would be born to the new covenant. And I think when you pointed out in 1 Corinthians 15 was the change that he was referring to, the change that would happen for an old covenant person. There, when I was brought up in Pentecostal and Baptist churches, we were talked about that we needed to be born again. And a lot of that context was brought up by John 3, that it was talked about being a spiritual birth, that you need to be spiritually born again. Well, first I would ask, do you think that that's a reality with John 3, or is it possible that Jesus was talking to Nicodemus about a natural birth?
Well, why can't it be both? See, the Jews looked at physical birth as a creation. It's a genesis of a human being when you're born, and right. if you're reborn, which is what they refer to as banai, a rebirth, a second birth. They're using that figuratively, referring to one spiritually being reborn.
Now, I believe that's a possibility, but in the context that I think John is talking to Nicodemus, I believe that he's talking to him in a legitimate physical sense. I think he's telling him, and my belief is that he told Nicodemus that he really needed to be born again because the kingdom was now on the scene. And there was a difference between born to the old covenant and being born to the new covenant.
Now, that's a stretch.
I understand.
What did he say?
He says it's a stretch.
Okay.
Now, the one thing that I will say is, you remember the context that when Jesus was talking to the people when they brought the children to him?
Right.
I said, forsake not to bring in the children?
Right.
Do you know how old the kids were?
Well, no, we don't.
According to Luke, it says infants.
Hey, stop.
No, I thought you were asking in general. I'm trying to steal your thunder, big guy.
Yes, you are. Stop. All right.
Go ahead.
All right. You're right. Most of the time when we're talked about the children that are brought to, we never really thought about the concept about how old the kids were. Right. And I never really contemplated it. But I always seemed, because of covenants, there was always a significance about being born to something. There was always a placement theology in the Bible. But when I seen the context, when I finally got to Luke and read those same verses, and like Rick Welch was talking about, Luke actually writes that the children that were brought to Jesus were infants. They were very young, born. Now, the interesting thing is what Jesus says about the infants, is he says that the kingdom belongs to such as these.
Right.
Now, the belongs part is a past tense word.
Right.
How could children that were not old enough to know the gospel, were not old enough to know really who Jesus was, which I think possibly they knew some way, somehow, because who couldn't stand in the presence of him and not know who he is? But he says it belongs to them.
Well, you need to understand how the Jewish people conceive of covenant and how their children are born into the covenant.
Right. Absolutely.
Circumcised on the eighth day, just as soon as it's possible medically.
Yes, sir.
They're circumcised in the covenant. Now, why perform circumcision, which is a sign of a covenant, on children who are not the age of accountability yet? Well,
right.
That's because the Jewish people understand that the physical descendants of those parents who are in the covenant, they're committing themselves to raise that child in the covenant. And so from a covenant perspective, that child is born into the covenant. And so when he reaches the age of accountability or bar mitzvah or whatever, his question is not, should I join the covenant? But the question is, why should I leave the covenant that I was born into? See, and this is a totally different perspective than what we Christians today think of. We don't understand what the Jewish people mean when they talk about covenant theology. They
right.
believe that they're born into the covenant.
Exactly. I'm right there with you. So here's where I think this is, if you wanted a silver bullet, and you talked about it earlier in your testimony about context. Is it possible that Jesus is talking about now the people born during his day, because he already began before that moment, started talking about the kingdom being present on the earth, that people born during those days were now born to a new covenant realm, not an old covenant system? Because he specifically says that these children, that the kingdom belongs to these. And they were the ones, it wasn't 12-year-olds, it was infants, that they were being born into a new era.
Well, I think we would have to ask a Jewish rabbi who was a Christian at that point in the first century, ask him how he would understand that scenario. You know, and I can imagine what he would say. I would probably say that would be a little bit of a strange way to talk about it, because they would understand, as Jewish Christians, they would understand that a person is born into the covenant. If they'd already been born physically, then they were born into the covenant when their parents became believers. Because we notice in the book of Acts and two other places in Corinthians, and I think maybe Romans, it talks about when they were converted, when Gentiles were converted, or even Jews were converted, then they were immediately baptized, they and their whole household. So their whole household was brought into the new covenant with them at baptism.
Gotcha. And that would be, I agree with you, from an old covenant perspective person, and most likely an older family, right? When they would be baptized during the days like John the Baptist, they would be converted. And this would be a part of the change that would go on during the transition period of the old covenant to the new covenant.
Right. Yeah. And their children were brought into the new covenant with them. Just like the Old Testament,
if they were
Jewish people believe.
And this is the part, and it's just open for discussion as far as at some point in time, and you're right, I believe that birth was important to the Jewish people, and that's what they meant, was when you were born to that system. And that's the context that Jesus, I feel, is in those texts are talking about, that children born during those days, at that time, there was a new covenant on the scene.
Yeah, if parents were Christians, yeah.
Well,
they were born into the covenant.
Here's the interesting part. I agree with you on the context, or what you're saying, but it would only apply to the fact that they were born at a certain age, they were born to the old system. There has to be a linchpin of a beginning of a new thing. So I think at a certain point in time, there were children that were born to the new covenant, but their parents, because of their age, they had already been born under the context of John 3. They were still attached to the old covenant.
Right. And so they came into the covenant with their parents when they were baptized.
I'm a believer we're in agreement on this one. On this one.
Yeah. They and their whole household, see, were baptized. And so when their parents became believers and were baptized, they brought their whole household into the covenant with them.
Gotcha.
And the fact is, those parents are bringing their children to Jesus.
Yes.
They're not taking them to the high priest. And we can assume that if they were male infants, that they were over 8 days old and had already been circumcised, or that they weren't. Who knows? That's all speculation at best.
It is. It is. Because the interesting part is, there's Paul, between Jesus and what Paul is talking about, there's a huge difference in something about birth. There was a birth born of flesh. When we go back to when you talked in 1 Corinthians 15, where Paul says flesh and flesh and blood cannot inherit the kingdom of God. Now, I understand that, and you may believe this, that most people would say that Paul is talking about flesh and blood, us today, or anybody in general, all the way back from Abraham till today. That flesh and blood in itself cannot inherit the kingdom of God, that you need to be changed into a different thing, right?
Yeah, and what I think flesh and blood means is it's referring to mere mortal bodies, bodies that are not immortal like Jesus. Jesus was sinless, therefore he had immortality. But the rest of us have all sinned, therefore, our bodies are just sinful flesh and blood. And that kind of sinful body cannot inherit heaven, cannot dwell in the unseen realm in God's presence. Just can't be there.
So what if he's referring, in the context that we were just talking about, the difference between the old covenant and the new covenant? The 1 Corinthians 15 could possibly be that Paul is talking about that an old covenant person, in their current state, without transition, cannot inherit the kingdom. In the same sense that Jesus told John, or John told Nicodemus, he said, Jesus, unless you're born, or told Nicodemus, is that you cannot see the kingdom unless you're born again. Also, Paul is writing, and we had some help finding it earlier in Romans 17, about the difference between born of flesh and the difference of being born in the spirit. Paul tells us between that Hagar had a child born of the flesh, and that Sarah had a child born of the spirit. There's two significant differences between their births. Now, also the interesting, and I hate to bounce around a lot, but the conversation between Nicodemus and Jesus says that the spirit goes wherever it wants to, and you don't know who is born of the spirit. The interesting thing is that Jesus sitting in front of him was a man born of the Spirit. And Nicodemus couldn't see it. Because being born of the Spirit was on the inside. It wasn't an outside thing. And that's something that you would never define. So I'm feeling that in John, or in 1 Corinthians 15, that Paul is definitely defining, for at least for me at the moment, is that he's talking about that old covenant people in their current state could not enter into the kingdom, which Jesus already had begun, had established, and it started to grow until they'd gone through a conversion, which we talked about through baptism, and belief in Christ.
Yeah, I don't, that may be a possible interpretation, but I don't see it validated by the context, especially verses 51 through 54. It seems very clearly to be pointing out two different kinds of body.
Right.
Mortal body versus an immortal body.
Right.
Rather than two different states of a person spiritually.
Well, anybody born into the kingdom or the new covenant wouldn't die. So that means they were, in essence, spiritually incorruptible. Anybody born to the old covenant was a corrupted person. They were born into sin.
Yeah, but I think that's redefining the terms in an unnatural way. I wouldn't define those terms that way.
Okay.
And I don't think the context would define them that way.
Gotcha. Okay.
So just because we've already been in an hour and I don't want to keep going all night, maybe Mr. Stevens, in the future, we could do this again. I would love to be able to sit down with you and ask you questions. I want to get in. What I want to do is I'm going to read this thoroughly and then come back to you because I really want to know.
So I can't wait to read it too.
I know, guys. Obviously, if you will you please tell us your website?
Yes, that's www.preterist.org.
Awesome.
www.preterist.org. You can go there and you can find this book. If you've never heard such a thing, and I know it sounds wild, but I'm telling you guys, it's very compelling. I'm only halfway through it, and I'm like, what's going on? I'm loving it. Expectations Demand a First Century Rapture by Edward E. Stevens. Mr. Stevens, thank you so much for giving us your time today.
Very welcome.
Thank you.
Thank you, Rich.
Yeah, absolutely. Yes, we'll be back in touch. And hopefully I'll send an email to you guys so that Rick, you can get his book to you. And then maybe we can set up something in the future.
Absolutely. I'm
game for it. All right. Well, thank you both. I really appreciate it. And look forward to talking to you in the future.
All right. Later, everybody.
God bless. Thanks. Bye-bye. God bless.
Hey, guys, this is Rick from the Burrows of Berea. A lot of people have been asking us, hey, what is this Patreon thing? Our old Patreon ad didn't work very well. So here you go, guys. Go to www.patreon, that is patreon.com. Let me do that again. patreon.com/TheBurrows of Berea. If you go to the Patreon page, you will find that we have different levels that you can give at. We have a $3 level, a $5 level. We've got a $10 level and a $20 level. I thought about putting a $1,000 level there, but you never know how that's going to work out, right, Andy? That's right. So go to www.patreon.com/TheBurrows of Berea and give us all of your money.
even a little bit will be fine.
Yeah. And that 5,000 wouldn't hurt my either.
No, it would hurt nobody.
Thanks, guys.
Hey, I was doing some silly reads because I don't know. I got the urge and I didn't want to put them on the front of the episode because I was worried somebody might misconstrue me being a goofy Gus as somehow making fun of the episode that would follow me being a goofy Gus. So I ultimately just used a normal read. But here are my silly reads. They're not even that funny. I just put them here because I have the power to do so. Yeah, this is me doing goofy reads.
Hey guys. This is Andy. This episode is a follow-up to the Ed Stevens interview. Rick and Big Daddy Carter sit down to ask questions and discuss his work on the topic of full preterism. Enjoy.
Hey guys, this is Andy. This episode is a follow-up to the Ed Stevens interview. Rick and Big Daddy Carter sit back down with him to ask questions and discuss his work on the topic of full preterism. We do hope you enjoy.